And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
You know, I think your brain produces a chemical that blocks out my voice.
What?
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, but before we get to today's theme, I want to remind you to take today's poll up on my website, brainstormingonline.com. I ask a simple multiple-choice question. And the question is this: which would you rather have, a daughter of questionable morals or a daughter with no friends at all? Go up to the website, brainstormingonline.com, and cast your vote. Certainly there's a clear pattern emerging right now. Cast your vote, and I'll announce the overall winners on next Thursday's show. My website is brainstormingonline.com. That's brainstorming, S-T-O-R-M-I-N, online.com. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is potpourri. Each of my guests is discussing an interesting topic, no two of which are related. My next guest presents controversial ideas on the U.S.-Iran relations. He's the president of the National Iranian American Council. We'll discuss his proposals in his book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. And as always, if you want to join in the conversation or if you have a question, you can call us at 639-0008. Trita Parsi is the 2010 recipient of the Gramera Award for Ideas Improving World Order. He's the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and an expert on U.S.-Iranian relations, Iranian foreign policy, and the geopolitics of the Middle East. In Trita's latest book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, he interviewed 70 high-ranking officials from the U.S., Iran, Europe, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Brazil, including the top American and Iranian negotiators. Trita was born in Iran but moved with his family at the age of 4 to Sweden in order to escape political repression in Iran. He moved to the United States as an adult and studied foreign policy at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, where he received his Ph.D. In addition to his Ph.D., he holds a master's degree in international relations from Uppsala University and a master's degree in economics from the Stockholm School of Economics. He served as an adjunct professor at the International Relations at Johns Hopkins University. He's fluent in Persian, Farsi, English, Swedish, and your articles, Trita's articles, have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, our own L.A. Times, and all of the major publications. And he's been a guest on CNN, PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, NPR, BBC, and Al Jazeera. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Trita, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being our guest today. And you're going to help us, I hope, unravel some things that have been very confusing to me when it comes to U.S. foreign policy in general. But let's start. Perhaps you can clarify President Obama's foreign policy in the Middle East. We apply sanctions to Iran because we believe that they're developing nuclear weapons capabilities, presumably because we're an ally of Israel. Now, here's the inconsistency. Let's take a look at another American ally, that's South Korea. We believe that North Korea has nuclear weapons capabilities, yet we're not imposing sanctions against North Korea. Or let's look at another Islamic regime, Pakistan. We know that both Pakistan and India have nuclear weapons capabilities, yet we're not imposing sanctions against Pakistan. So why and how do we justify our foreign policy against Iran?
There's hardly any policies that have consistency. I do believe we have strict sanctions on North Korea, however. But in the case of India and Pakistan, two countries that actually never signed a non-proliferation treaty, then went and built and tested the bomb, we had some limited sanctions for a short period of time. And then later on, we even rewarded India by giving it massive collaboration on its nuclear program, in spite of the fact that it's actually not part of the non-proliferation treaty. At the same time, these inconsistencies, in my assessment at least, does not justify what the Iranian government is doing when it comes to its nuclear program, the lack of transparency and the suspicions that exist around it. We have to find a solution to these things. The more consistent our policies are and the more consistently we pursue them, the higher the likelihood that we can have some success. And so far, unfortunately, there's not a lot of successes to point to.
No, there has not been much success at all, Trita. So let's talk about this. What are the United States' biggest fears about the Iranian nuclear program?
I think the biggest fear in regards to the nuclear program in Iran is not necessarily that the Iranians would build a bomb and actually use it and try to nuke Israel, but the real fear is that the Iranian bomb, if it ever were to be built, would spark an arms race in the region, and you would have other states such as Saudi Arabia and others building or buying bombs, and you would have an uncontrollable situation in the Middle East in which states with very few relations, tremendous amount of suspicion with each other, long history of rivalries and conflict, would be sitting on these nuclear weapons without having the proper types of control mechanisms. Between the Soviet Union and the United States, there was an entire industry that was developed on nuclear security, an industry that required certain levels of maturity and depth in the States. In the Middle East, one can make the argument that that depth and maturity doesn't exist, so having proliferation of nuclear weapons in the region would arguably be quite disastrous.
My guest is Trita Parsi. We're talking about his book, A Single Roll of the Dice. And Trita, I want to push back a little bit because aren't we seeing the second gambit in a nuclear arms race happening in the Middle East right now? We strongly suspect that Israel has nuclear weapons capability, and Iran can make the argument that they're merely ramping up so that they're on par with what Israel already has.
It is correct. We know that Israel has nuclear weapons, and we are on the record acknowledging their nuclear weapons. Israel has a policy of not acknowledging or denying their own arsenal. But the U.S. knows that it has it. There's been some push to get the Israelis to pursue greater transparency on this issue. One can definitely make the argument that if the Israeli bomb didn't lead to a massive non-proliferation risk, why would the Iranian one do so? We have some counter evidence to that. You know, we have signals from both Turkey, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia that they're starting to take a look into a nuclear program. And some of their officials have even warned that unless the world stops Iran from building a bomb, they will feel essentially forced to pursue one of their own. But I think we have to also we have to take into account that Iran is a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That should mean that it has a right to enrichment, and we should not pursue an approach in which we're trying to essentially completely eliminate the enrichment program. But it also means that they have forsworn nuclear weapons. And whether Israel has it or not cannot then be an argument for the Iranians getting a nuclear weapon because they're a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Well, that's an interesting point. My guest is Trita Parsi. So, Trita, let's take a look at other governments and how they're viewing Iran and Iran's nuclear program. And specifically, let's look at some other superpowers with nuclear weapons, China and Russia in specific. What is their foreign policy towards Iran, and in what ways is it different than the United States' foreign policy?
The United States and Israel are the drivers, and to a certain extent, Francis Sarkozy are the drivers of the approach of pressuring Iran, sanctioning Iran, and essentially punishing Iran. We don't have that impetus coming from the Russians and the Chinese. On the contrary, they have extensive relations with Iran, a broad agenda of issues that they discuss with Iranians. They do have trade. The Chinese in particular import a lot of Iranian oil. And they're concerned that on the one hand, Iran would actually get a capability or build a bomb that would be destabilizing. But they're at times even more concerned that the approach that the West is pursuing is actually increasing the risk of a military conflict in the region. Up until recently, they were supportive of new sanctions, but now have made it quite clear they're not supporting any additional sanctions because they don't view the sanctions being essentially anything different from a declaration of war at this point.
Well, hold on. Make the case there, because I wanted to come to sanctions next, so I'm glad you went down this path, because as a failed foreign policy, we look at the sanctions, and from my point of view, the sanctions are very effective, and they're making a great hardship for the Iranian people. But instead of driving a wedge between the Iranian people and the government, it seems to be drawing the Iranian people more with the government, in line with the government, and against the United States. So why would Russia and China view this as being a precursor to war or as militaristic as war?
Well, because at the end of the day, this level of sanctions in the past, in the other cases that we have seen, have either led to a situation in which a very authoritative government remains in power and becomes more problematic and likely obtains a nuclear weapon, or it has led to war. I mean, we saw what happened in Iraq. We had massive sanctions on the Saddam Hussein government, and eventually we nevertheless invaded that country. So there is that concern on the Israelis that Chinese, on the Russian and the Chinese side. The Chinese in particular want stability in the region. They just want to have a stable flow of energy so that they can continue to develop their economy and bring millions of their own people out of poverty. And much of the foreign policy initiatives and approaches of the United States are oftentimes viewed by the Chinese as destabilizing.
Well, an interesting point of view. My guest is Trita Parsi, author of the book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. And staying with the subtitle of your book, Obama's Diplomacy, how does the Iranian regime view President Obama's 2009 speech to the Muslim world that he gave in Cairo, Egypt? Did this speech strengthen or did it weaken our relationship with Iran?
Well, it was very interesting because that speech came on the eve, of course, of the Iranians' own presidential elections. And election was a fraudulent election, massive human rights abuses, etc. So the Iranian government has been pretty much paralyzed and at times in very intense war with itself since those June elections. But what Obama's outreach to the Iranians did is that it had the opportunity, the potential of really changing the dynamic between the two countries. The problem was, however, from Obama's own end, that the political space and capital that Obama had to pursue this policy in a sustained fashion, so it wouldn't be an one-off thing, was very limited. By the time Obama managed to get everyone to the table in October 2009 for a negotiation, it ended up being, as one Obama administration official explained to me, a gamble on a single roll of the dice, hence the title of the book.
Mm.
It had to work either immediately or not at all. We didn't have the time, the patience, the political capital, the will, the courage to pursue this further than that. And very seldomly does negotiations succeed in such a fashion, and they didn't do it in this time either. And ever since, we've been on the sanctions track, which, as you explained, has put a lot of hardship on the Iranian people, has put a lot of pain on the Iranian economy as a whole, but has not fundamentally changed the Iranian government calculation in regards to their nuclear program.
My guest is Trita Parsi. We're talking about U.S.-Iranian diplomacy. Trita, there's a 50-50 chance that there's going to be a regime change here in the United States following the 2012 presidential election. How would the Iranian government view a Republican president if he was elected to the office?
Well, based on the rhetoric that has come out of the Republican primary so far, with the exception of Ron Paul, it seems to me that it's quite likely that the Iranians would view the election of a Republican as a clear indication that that the two countries would be heading towards a military confrontation. At least if these Republican candidates try to live up to the promises that they have made in the campaign.
All right, so it begs the bigger question, and I'm going to ask this of you. What type of stance must the United States take with Iran, and what are some of the long-term benefits that there can be for the United States by engaging Iran in diplomacy?
I think that's a critical question that we should be asking ourselves right now, and I think it's quite clear. If you listen to the U.S. military, they do not want another war in the region right now. We're already overstretched. We have already had war for about 10 years now. It's been tremendously devastating for the American economy, for the military as a whole. So the military wants the politicians to shoulder their responsibility and try to find a non-lethal and non-military solution to this. So how is that done then? Well, it is done through diplomacy. But diplomacy that succeeds is diplomacy in which you invest your courage, your political capital. It's persistent, it's sustainable, it doesn't fail at the first hinder, an obstacle on the road. It has sufficient strength to overcome even the last hurdle on the road. That was not the type of diplomacy that the U.S. and Iran engaged in 2009. On the contrary, it ended up becoming more of an exchange of ultimatums between the two rather than a real negotiation. If there is a real negotiation, a sustainable one, a similar one to those that the U.S. has conducted with countries like Vietnam, Libya, or in Northern Ireland where the U.S. mediated, in which they were successful, then we have to be prepared that it's going to take a few years at a minimum, but the outcome is going to be far superior any other outcome of either economic sanctions or military operations.
And yet we're seeing this administration is not in wanting to engage in that. As recently as today, there's a newspaper article about an Iranian semiconductor engineer has been jailed for fear of stealing secrets. And now he is in jail. They're negotiating whether they're going to let him out on bail with an ankle bracelet and that kind of stuff. So the actions of the government don't seem to be leaning towards negotiations at any time soon. What will cause the government to change their position?
You're absolutely right. Neither the Iranian government nor the U.S. government are making things easier for diplomacy to begin. I think the U.S. calculation is that by having massive sanctions, we will force the Iranians to the table. I think it is somewhat misguided. Even if you get them to the table, any deal that is coming through coercion is not likely to last anyways. I think what we'll need is the type of political courage that leaders have shown throughout history when they have realized that there is a strategic choice that they have to make for their country, but it's going to be a very difficult and tricky one. And even if they do so, they will have to be agreed to pay a political price for that political courage, but they agree to do so. For instance, when Yitzhak Rabin in Israel realized that it lied in the interest of the Israeli nation to make some sort of a peace with the Palestinians, he knew it was a tough sell. He knew it would be difficult, but he approached it without any apologies. The quote that he constantly repeated was, "I make peace with my enemies, not with my friends." And it's that type of a strong leadership that is needed on all sides in order for it to succeed.
My guest is Trita Parsi, author of the book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Trita, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book, A Single Roll of the Dice?
It's an assessment. I mean, I'm spending time with the negotiators, with officials from all of the countries involved, including, of course, the Obama White House and the Iranian government. It's an account of what happened, why things didn't work out in the way that I think Obama would have liked to, why we're consistently repeating the same mistakes, and the fact that if we actually go towards a military confrontation in the next year or so, we should be aware that we're doing so without having exhausted diplomacy first. And that, I think, would be a tremendous shame and something that would completely counter the longer-term interests of the United States.
My guest has been Trita Parsi. Trita, if people are intrigued by what you have to say, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
The book can be found at Amazon.com, both the Kindle version as well as the physical copy. And my website is TritaParsi.com, TritaParsi.com. And that's the way for them to read my articles as well as getting in touch with me if they would so like to.
TritaParsi.com. Trita, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.